The climb to Formula One is a difficult one. Drivers have to prove they are worthy.
He has conquered a super talented field, and George Russell is the Formula 2 champion of 2018. The moment has arrived for the Prima man. Oscar Piastri wins the Formula 2 championship of 2021.
They are just the latest stars who made their names by winning the series below F1. Formula 2 and Formula 3 are the final rungs on the ladder. The ladder built by Bruno Michel.
My job is to try to get the drivers into Formula 1 teams one way or another. I'm not really making stars, you know. I'm giving them the means to show their capacities, but honestly, the teams are making stars much more than I do.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. It's 20 years since Bruno Michel launched a new racing series for drivers who want to make it to F1. GP2, as it was first known, replaced Formula 3000, the category which had helped launch many F1 drivers' careers. It immediately delivered. 2005 GP2 champion Nico Rosberg graduated to F1 the following season, as did 2006 winner Lewis Hamilton. Racing in identical cars, on Grand Prix circuits, on F1 weekends, it's the perfect way to get noticed by an F1 team. The stars born in GP2, F2 and F3 have gone on to win F1 races and world championships. 15 of today's F1 drivers came from those categories. So how did Bruno build the ladder which so many have climbed? We talk about how the series has evolved, the drivers who've risen through the ranks, standout performances from Lewis Hamilton and Charles Leclerc, and the path for F3's Sophia Flörsch and F1 Academy frontrunners Abby Pulling and Dorian Pan. Bruno tells us about his previous work as a driver manager for the likes of Fernando Alonso and Mark Webber, and how F2 has become a testbed for F1 innovations. Bigger tyres, sustainable fuel, and maybe new ways of racing. And we look forward to the next drivers to make the leap from F2 to F1. Ollie Bearman is already confirmed for 2025. Will Kimi Antonelli be next? I hope you enjoy our conversation. Bruno, many thanks for coming on the show. It's great to see you. How are things?
Well, things are good. You know, we're going to through the season now, and so far everything's been fine.
How are the 2024 championships shaping up?
Well, they're really good. F2, I must say, I think we have a quality of the grid, which is quite amazing this year, which makes the championship extremely interesting. We have young rookie drivers that are doing very well. We have a little bit more experienced drivers that are also doing very well. So the championship is very, very tight at the moment. And especially because it's a new car. And it's always interesting to see how the new car is behaving, because when you come up with a new car, and we had the old car for 6 years, so it was quite interesting to see what the new car was going to be like. And so far, we are extremely happy with what we've been seeing with the new F2 car.
In terms of performance, is that new Formula 2 car where you wanted it to be?
Yeah. It's always a quite tricky thing to put together a new car, because F2 has a few basic values, let's put it that way, which is that, number one, the car has to prepare the drivers for Formula 1. And that's the number one quality that we want from a new car. Number two, it has to be safe. Number three, it has to be to perform as well as possible. Number four, it has to be as cheap as possible. And it's all these things that we need to put together. And number five, of course, we have to have great entertainment as well on the track, because otherwise F1 people are not watching us.
Well, so, you're a tough taskmaster, because all five of those targets, if you like, have huge merit. From a performance point of view, you say you're trying to get a car that will prepare drivers for Formula 1. You're producing one car for the entire grid. So how do you do that? How do you prepare a driver for Formula 1, where each team is producing only two cars effectively?
We have to make it as simple as possible, but we have to make it as performing as possible, as you're saying. And that's the old balance that we have to find. We have to find cheap ways to do complicated things. If you look, for instance, at what we're doing with the DRS, we have a DRS that is extremely efficient in Formula 2, but it's working very, very differently from the Formula 1 DRS in terms of data, in terms of exchange of information. And it's a very simple system. The hydraulic system that we're having is quite simple as well. And that's the kind of thing that we're always trying to do, is to have a car that is as close as possible to a Formula 1. Not only in terms of performance, but also in terms of system, in terms of working with all the electronics, in terms of working with the marshalling systems, with the race control. We're using exactly the same system as Formula One, but we're trying to make it cheap, because we have a real issue otherwise, that drivers won't be able to sustain the cost of a season. So it's something that we need always to be extremely careful about. And when I say also about entertainment, we need to have a car that overtakes and that can overtake as much as possible. And I must say, so far, the F2 car this season have been absolutely amazing. In Bahrain, we had fantastic races. In Melbourne, we had fantastic races. And in Monaco, our feature race in Monaco, my God, I think we had 26 overtaking, which is something quite incredible for Monaco. And the race was amazing. So that's really what we are trying to do and to achieve. And it's a very thin balance, but we're working on that. And we've been doing that for quite a while. So we got a bit of experience. And of course, we helped in that by Dallara, who's been working with us for a long time, by Mika Krohm, who's been working with us for a long time as well. So far, it's working.
And in terms of lap time, how far off Formula One does the car want to be? Do you set yourself a goal? Do you set
no? We don't. Okay. There's been time in the past where a GP2 car could have passed Q1 in Formula One. There's been a couple of seasons like that, but that was very specific. Let's put it that way. No, we are not trying to set up a lap time. What we're trying to do is that we have a car that is safer and safer, which means heavier and heavier. That's part of it. We all have the same issue. And we want to make sure that whatever additional weight we put on the car to make it safer is not going to change the performance of the car. And we're faster this year in terms of lap time than last car, even if the car is heavier. So that's also quite important. After that, it depends on the track. Some tracks were 10 seconds away. Some tracks were 7, 8 seconds. It really depends. But I don't think we need to set up a target for that. It's not, it's a one-make championship as well. So it doesn't make a big, big difference. And it's something that we've been discussing, whether it's with Pirelli or whether it's with Aramco for the fuel. If we lose a little bit of horsepower, it doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, what we want to achieve is something sustainable and not something that is getting more performance. So we're not like Formula One for that.
You mentioned the big E, entertainment, overtaking. And yes, Monaco was an amazing race. I remember that move. Was it Ollie Bearman on
amazing.
It was an amazing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely amazing. Yeah.
On Kimi Antonelli. But look, on the subject of overtaking, I did want to ask you about your reverse grid format that you use on a Saturday. Where did that idea come from, and how is it received by drivers, by teams? Did you have some resistance when you first brought it in, or do they see it as an opportunity to show what they can do?
Of course we did. When we started GP2 in 2005, and we said that we wanted to introduce a reverse grid for the second race of the weekend, we had a lot of criticism of people saying, this is not motor racing anymore. This is a circus. And actually, all the critics stopped because, number one, it brought some really interesting racings. Number two, it helped also the teams and the drivers, because some drivers need some support, and to be able to shine on the reverse grid race is quite important for them, for their career. And number three, at the end of the day, the best driver always wins. And we never had any issue of championship where a driver would not have won because of the reverse grid. It doesn't exist. So for me, it's a very, very important thing. Now, we've been changing the format a few times over the last 20 years because we're trying to be as pragmatic as possible. And sometimes the format that we put in place was not so efficient. The one we have now and the one we'll be having for the last years, for me, is perfect. But it's a very complicated way. We're not doing reverse grid with, you know, you need to make sure that you attribute the right number of points for the reverse grid. You need to make sure that you reverse the right number of cars for the reverse grid as well. And it's a quite long process for us to find out exactly how we want to do it.
Do you think it would work in Formula One?
For the sprint race? Of course, I would think.
I mean, have you had that conversation with Stefano
Domenicali? Yes, of course I did. Of course I did.
And are you getting resistance from him? Or does
no,
he,
not from him.
He's open to it.
He's absolutely open to that. There are resistances, of course. But for me, it would be a great opportunity, for sure. Being extremely careful as well on how many cars you reverse and how many points you attribute. That's the key element of a reverse grid. But if you do it properly, and doing it properly, you have to make sure of one thing, that when... If nothing happens over a race weekend, if no drivers overtake no drivers, then the drivers on pole position should have more points. The second driver should have the second more points. You know, it's the way it's working, and it's a quite interesting exercise.
Bruno, whether it's conversations with Stefano about reverse grids, whether it's the sustainable fuel that you're running this year, 55% sustainable, whether it was you introducing the 18-inch tyres before they came to Formula One. Do you feel that F2 is a test bed for Formula One in many respects?
Yes, it is. We're doing it for F2, but we're also doing it to be a test bed for F1, definitely. And we've done that for the 18-inch tyres, definitely. And we've done that 2 years before, which was very good also for Pirelli, because Pirelli could work with us on the development of the future Formula One tyres. We've done that, of course, with the fuel. We're doing something quite specific as well. With the reverse grid might be a possibility to do that. And there are a lot of subjects on which we can work, you know, even on the regulations. Sometimes we make some changes in the regulations because it's easier for us, because it's just between the FIA and us that we have to agree, and it's not such a complicated governance as Formula One has. And of course, F1 is looking at what we're doing as well, if we want to change things and where we want to do that.
Do you know, I love the idea of reverse sprint races in Formula One. And I think what's interesting now is that most of the drivers on the grid have come through your system. So they've experienced the reverse grid. It's nothing new to them. They know the positives and, I suppose, the negatives on if you're on the wrong end of the reverse grid. But I think it would get a vote of confidence.
But definitely. It gives something different. You know, already the introduction of a sprint race in Formula One was not something that was so easy to do. And Stefano had to fight for that. And I think at the end of the day, the races where we have that are very interesting. Okay, it's a different format. You need to get used to it. There are many, many factors. But at the end of the day, it's a very good idea. And I think it can go further, yeah.
We've discussed F2. You're also the boss of F3. And there's a big change coming for 2025. You've got a new car arriving. And then you look at the schedule and you think, oh my goodness, the first race is on the other side of the world in Australia. What sort of a headache does that give the boss?
We have a little bit of experience now. Let's put it that way. You know, we've done that a few times. So I'm not saying we're not going to go through difficulties and sometimes crises, but we know we're starting always quite in advance. The new car is already completely designed. The first prototype has been put together and has started already. We are going to do the shakedown of the new car very, very soon. Tatiana Calderon will do it for us. And then we have a quite long development campaign process over the following 3 or 4 months before we start the mass production of the car. And then we tell the team that they will get the first car in January, the second car in February. We organize tests and then we go for it. So sometimes, let's say that it's a little bit more stressful than others. We had cars that had zero reliability issues. We had cars that had a little bit more. But it's a process that we control quite well. And also the fact that we've been working with the same partners for the last 20 years. And we know each other by heart, makes our life also easier. And whether it is with Dallara, who's also working on the design of the car, with Pirelli, of course with the FIA, who's present at all the different steps of the development, but with Pirelli as well, because we're having quite a lot of development of tires with Pirelli. because also Pirelli plays a very, very important role in the entertainment of the races. We know exactly where we want to be, and Mario knows exactly where we want to be, and it's a very interesting challenge for them also to be able to provide us the tires that are going to have the effect that we want on the track.
So the fact that the first race is in Melbourne actually makes no difference. You're going to take nothing different to Melbourne that you would have taken to Barcelona if that was the first race?
No, we need to get organized to have a test in Europe before, or maybe in Bahrain, I don't know yet. That's something that we're working on, so it's working. The testing program for the teams might be a little bit different. After that, you know, the logistics to go to Melbourne is not more complicated than the logistics to go to Bahrain. Where we could have an issue is if we're missing some parts, for instance. Because if you're missing parts and you're in Barcelona, it doesn't really matter because Dallara is next door. If you're missing parts and you're in Melbourne, then it's a little bit more of a headache. So that's where we need to be a little bit more careful. But starting in Melbourne for us is not an issue. And on the other end, I think it's a fantastic challenge.
Bruno, it strikes me that one of your biggest qualities has to be diplomacy, because I don't know how you keep all of the people happy all of the time.
I don't.
Because it must be hard, because this is motorsport, things break. That's
People happy all the time. Yeah, the relationship with the teams I have is very good because most of the teams have been with me for such a long time now. They were with me in GP2, they were with me in GP3, they joined F2 and F3, and we have a quite long trust relationship. But sometimes they're being hard on us. And we've been through difficulties, either reliability or either availability. And in that case, don't think they're nice. But at the end of the day, you know, we get through because I think, and I want to give them a lot of credit for that, the teams understand, whether it's in F2 or in F3, that we're all on the same boat and that we need to work together to make things better and to make things happen. And if we have issues, they stay behind closed doors and they don't go out. And I think that's something that is extremely important. And it's true on my side and it's true on their side as well.
It's incredible, I think, how the series have grown since 2005 when you introduced GP2 from what was Formula 3000. Have you got everything where you want it now?
Never. We always want to move forward. We always want to, you know, change things. I think, you know, if we've been surviving so long where so many other series disappeared, it's because we have been extremely careful to stay always in line with the market. And it's true for the car, it's true for the economical situation as well, because sometimes, you know, at the moment, there is money in motor racing, but we've been going through cycles where there was money, there was no money, there was money again, and we need to be extremely careful. When the teams were struggling at some point, whether it's after the 2008 crisis or whether it's after the COVID, we helped the teams because we wanted to make sure that they could continue to operate properly. We just need to always be careful, and it's true for the format, it's true for the economy, it's true for everything. We always are listening to the market and understanding what is happening. And the teams for that are very good because they give us a feedback, because a lot of teams are also in Formula 4, in Formula Regional, and it's through them that I understand what's happening and that I can, you know, make decisions and strategic decisions on how we want to move. So it's extremely important. And also, I would say on that, Stefano is extremely helpful because Stefano is a racer and he loves his racing and he understands what we're doing and he's got also a very important input on what we're doing.
Would you like to see more races? I mean, you introduced Melbourne a couple of years ago. That was a massive step. Would you like to see some races maybe on the other side of the Atlantic in the Americas?
Yes, maybe. The situation is that Formula One is having 24 races. I can't do that. I can't do that for economic reasons. It's quite simple.
That's an interesting point. Financial reasons would stop you doing every race.
Absolutely. It would make the cost of a season absolutely crazy and nobody could afford it. So we have to be careful. We used to have 10 races, then 12 races. Now we're having 14. So we've been increasing because Stefano is pushing. He would like us to be everywhere, which I'm very glad to hear. And also more and more promoters want us to come because it's true that when you have F2 and F3 over an F1 weekend, it's different. When you have F1 weekends with no support races or with non-interesting support races, it makes a big difference. But on the other hand, I have to be extremely careful. When I increased the number of races from 12 to 14, I've been helping financially the teams for the additional two races. And that's the kind of thing I have to do to make sure that I'm not destroying the thin balance of this business. After that, where would we race? Of course, I'd like to get a race in America, but I have to find the proper agreement with them to race there, which I have not found yet.
Have you discussed?
I've discussed with Miami, I've discussed with Austin, yes, but at the moment we have not really agreed. But we're working on that, and there will be other possibilities, because as you say, I'd like to be on this side of the Atlantic as well. Asia, so far we're going to the Middle East and going quite a lot to the Middle East, which is great because the trucks are great and it's very easy to work, and it's really a part of the world where everybody likes to go. But we can go in other places, but that will be maybe to the detriment of European races as well. So we need to be very careful on the balance, and I'm not going to increase the number of races to the number of races of Formula One, that's for sure.
Well, look, Bruno, let's talk about drivers. Here and now, first of all, it looks like at least two of the current F2 grid are going to get the bump up to Formula One next year. Can we talk about these two guys? Perhaps Ollie Bearman, first of all. Were you surprised by the amazing job he did in a Ferrari in Saudi Arabia earlier this year? Or did you expect that of him?
Well, it's always, for a young driver like that, it's quite a big gamble. They go there suddenly, and especially, you know, after he had done FP1 with us, a free practice with us, and he just had to jump
in the car. I think he was on pole, actually.
He was on pole, and then suddenly he was called, Fred called me and said, you know, I'm going to take your driver. I said, wow. So it was a big thing, and I must say that I knew Ollie had the quality to do well, but also you have to be extremely strong in your head to be able to go into this kind of situation so suddenly and to arrive and to deliver. And that's where you don't know. And I must say, I knew how fast Ollie can be. I know how strong he can be. You know, last year he had a couple of weekends. The weekend in Baku he did was absolutely amazing. So I knew the quality of Ollie. There's no doubt about that and how strong he can be. But then, you know, showing what he did over this race weekend with Ferrari was absolutely amazing. It was great. And it's fantastic because it's a good credit for him and for us as well in terms of preparation. And I was so happy to see that. And I think after that, going back to F2, after the hype of F1 and the visibility, of course, is another challenge. Let's put it that way. But Ollie's a great driver. There's no doubt about that.
It was an interesting moment, wasn't it? Because, yes, there was the pressure of a red car being in a Ferrari. But equally, Fred Vasseur is someone you know very well, of course, you know, from your GP2 days together. Fred is so brilliant with young drivers as well that, yeah, you had the pressure on the one hand, but you also had Fred looking after him on the other. So were you sure, in a way, that that environment would get the best out of Ollie?
I was sure that the environment would do the best for him to perform. After that, it's up to him. You know, you can always do whatever you want. The driver is in the car. He's the one, you know, and he puts the visor down, and then it's up to him. So I knew that he was going to have the best environment as possible. Even, you know, it would have been better if he had known a little bit earlier, if he had been doing the FP1, if he had been, you know, many things could have been done differently. But that was the fact. It was like this. And of course, you don't say no to an opportunity like this one. And then he did fantastically well. And I was extremely happy because he showed, you know, and he showed that in this kind of situation, which he had never been in before, he was performing, and he was performing so well. So that's another level that he reached out of it, and that you don't know. You always think, yes, he can do it, but as long as he had not done it, you don't know. And it was a great example, we were so happy with him.
And another driver who looks like he's going to get the bump up to Formula One next year, Kimi Antonelli. Toto Wolff said in Canada that Kimi is part of our plans in the future. But he is young. He's 17, turns 18 at the end of August. How big an ask is it for a young guy, and he's a couple of years younger than Ollie Bearman, to deal with Formula One and the pressure that comes with it?
It's difficult. You know, sometimes I would hope for him that he would be left a little bit without this kind of pressure, because it's definitely difficult. It puts a lot of pressure on him. Kimi is a very strong driver. There's no doubt about that. He's strong because he's always been there. And he's very consistent. And he's doing a very good job as a rookie. But you have two other rookies that at the moment are in front of him in the championship. And maybe the fact that he didn't have an F3 season is also making an additional challenge for him that at some point I'm sure he will overcome. But it's for sure, it's not an easy situation for him. And it would be better if nobody was talking about him replacing next week or the week after or at the end of the season. Or he has to deliver in F2. I'm sure he's going to do it. He had so far weekends on most of the tracks he didn't know. So that makes a difference as well because he didn't do F3 and because some of them were even F3 is not going. But at the end of the day, now he's having tracks that he knows and that he's been racing on with in Formula Regional. And let's see. And I'm sure he will come up with strong weekends. And that's exactly what we want, to be in the same situation as we were with Oli last year in Baku and saying, wow, my God, you know, this is where you see that a driver is very special. And that's something I want to see from Kimi. And most likely will come up with this kind of weekend before the end of the season.
Bruno, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, you've managed drivers in the past. So I'm quite interested in your thoughts on this. I remember Lewis Hamilton doing 2 seasons in Formula 3. He wanted to progress up to GP2, but I think Martin Whitmarsh at McLaren made him do that second season in F3. He then dominates GP2 and, of course, comes into Formula 1 in 2007 and is quick straight away. So that's one way of doing it. But it seems to me that now drivers are being fast-tracked. The ones who have got that Formula 1 stamp on them are being fast-tracked, and they are missing out on some of that experience. Is that the reality? And with your experience of managing drivers, is it the right thing to do long term?
Yeah, some of them. You know, talking about Lewis, it was very interesting because Lewis arrived in GP2 as a rookie in GP2, and he started the season. And same thing, I had the feeling that he was very, very strong, probably quite special, but. Same thing, he had not put everything together in the same weekend. Sometimes quali was not so good, sometimes he was making a little bit of mistakes. But you could tell that when he was going to be ready, he would be really outstanding. And that's what happened. You know, I saw you mentioned Turkey race 2 in 2006. But it was quite incredible because...
Bruno, so what did he do? Didn't he drop back to like span, last or something?
He was starting in front, he span... And everybody passed, and he went back on the track. He was P17. And then he overtook everybody, absolutely everybody. He was on another planet in this race. And it was quite funny because at the end of the race, Bernie and Flavio called me and said, you know, you have to check this car. This is not possible. The guy, the team is cheating. It's completely impossible what he's done. And I said, yeah, I will check the car, but I can tell you one thing. The guy is very special. And I remember I was in the office of Bernie and Gerhard Berger was there as well. And Gerhard told the same to Bernie. He said, Bernie, you have no idea. This guy is very special. Of course, we checked the car. We didn't find anything in the car. But it was really amazing. And that's where, you know, I thought, wow, you know, this one is very special.
Turkey 2006. But do you think, just back to the fast tracking, do you think drivers are missing out on crucial parts of their education in the junior formulas by being fast-tracked?
Well, you know, it depends. You look at the latest one we had that has been maybe a little bit fast-tracking was Oscar Piastri, because he won F3 as a rookie. So normally goes to F2. He won F2 as a rookie. Then after that, he had 1 year of preparation with Alpine, but which was a little bit complicated. But Oscar was ready. And before him, we had George that did the same. We had Charles that did the same before. So I cannot say those guys are fast-tracking. You know, when you win as a rookie, it means really something. It's an incredible achievement. And a driver that wins Formula 2 as a rookie, all the F1 teams have to have a look at him because the guy is special. After that, some other situations are where some drivers might not be ready to go to the following step, and they still do it. It might work, but it might make things more complicated as well. So talking about Kimi, I'm waiting to see the second part of his season in Formula 2. And maybe the path that Mercedes decided for him is the correct one, because it's another challenge for him. You know, arriving in F2 and doing well in F2 as long as you have not done F3, it's difficult. And you see the other rookies that are in front of him now, Gabriele Bortoleto and Aaron, who's doing a great season. They've done F3. They've done, you know, even if Bortoleto won F3 as a rookie, so he's a very strong driver. But let's say that he doesn't have the same experience that these guys have been having, so he has to compete with that. So to answer to you, I think at some point, yeah, probably it's better to let the drivers mature. I can be completely wrong, and I really hope that Kimi is going to do fantastically in the second half of the season and will be a great driver in Formula One next year. It's completely possible as well.
It's interesting you mention Oscar Piastri, because, yes, to win F3 and F2 in his rookie seasons was amazing. Yet he will tell you now that when he came into Formula One last year with McLaren, he wasn't the complete package, particularly when it came to race management of tyres. He said it took him pretty much the whole of 2023 to get his head around that. So there was still a lot to learn for someone like Oscar, who'd done the ladder in its entirety, if you like.
Yeah, going to F1, you go into another dimension. It's completely true. And it's not only the tyre management, it's everything. It's the understanding of the car, it's the way the team is working. In F2, to control the cost, we limit the operating people to 12 people per team. Imagine when they get to an F1 garage. You know, it's just absolutely massive. And that's the kind of thing that they have to learn and to work with so many different people and on things that are so many more accurate. And of course, tires management that we try to prepare them with, using the same tires, the same tire manufacturer as Formula One, and also obliging them to work with two compounds over a race weekend is a start. But we're using two compounds. Formula One can use many more. So it's also a very, very different approach. But we could have 4 or 5 compounds over the race weekend, but then the cost would completely explode. So that's why we need to be careful. But Oscar is right. There are so many things you need to learn when you get to Formula One. And to be immediately spot on when you get to Formula One is also a very strong sign.
You're all about developing the F1 drivers of tomorrow. And we've talked about Behrmann, we've talked about Antonelli, and Oscar Piastri, but can I just get your thoughts on the drivers that stay in F2 in particular for a long period of time? I'm thinking in the past of Ralph Bochon, and then of, what do we got, Richard Vachon this year is in his 4th season. Where do they fit in to the jigsaw in your mind?
Well, they love F2. Talking about Ralph Bochon, you know, it's quite funny. I think Ralph Bochon is the drivers that we know that had the more races in F2. I don't know. I don't even know how many seasons he had. And every year he was coming at the end of the season and said, "Bruno, do you mind if I do another season?" And I said, "No. Why would I mind? You know, it's interesting to have drivers like this." The last season he did last year, after 2 rounds, he was leading the championship, which was quite interesting. And it's a benchmark for the other drivers as well. And after that, it's true that winning as a rookie is fantastic. Winning in a second year is, if you're doing, if you're on the path to F1, is something that you have to do. Winning in third year makes your life more difficult. You look at Théo Pourchaire, you look at Felipe Drugovic, they don't have a seat in F1 now. They might in the future, and I hope for them that it will come, but it's not so obvious. And when you talk to Formula One teams, they say, "Oh yeah, but he won in third year." So that also makes a difference.
Do you have contacts in series in America, for example? Like, do you try and help these guys get seats in IndyCar or maybe Super Formula in Japan? Or are you just purely focused on what you're doing in F2 and F3?
I'm purely focused on what I'm doing in F2 and F3. But also, my job is to try to get the drivers into Formula One teams one way or another. So, for instance, Felipe didn't know anybody in F1, or very little, when he was starting to win. So I took him to the F1 paddock and I started to introduce him to the team principals, because the guy didn't have such a strong image. So yes, I'm trying to do that. After that, no, I would say, you know, I'm not doing driver's management anymore. So I'm not going to try to find them a seat either in Japan or in America, or in Formula E. Formula E is also a good way out for the F2 drivers that cannot make it to F1. So it's, I would say it's part of their job and their management to do it. But my job is to make sure that in F1, people know them, but generally they see them on the track and they don't need me.
When you started GP2 back in 2005, you were very much dealing, tell me if I'm wrong, but dealing with individual drivers who were trying to make their way. Since then, there's been a proliferation of young driver academies, or they've all got different names, but these Formula One teams that have these academies where they spot talent and then they place them in one of your series. How has that changed your world, having these connections with the F1 teams? Has it made the step up to F1 easier for these guys? Has it made your dealings with Formula One easier? Or actually, was it easier back in the day just dealing with drivers on their own?
No, it makes it easier. These Formula One teams academies is something I started with Renault 25 years ago.
With Fernando and Jarno and Fisichella.
With Fernando and Jarno, yeah. And Mark Webber and Fisichella. And,
that's the Renault young driver program, we
put quite a lot of drivers in Formula One at that time. And then it's true that quite a lot of other F1 teams followed the path and started their academies. It's great. It's fantastic to have. Now, I think in F2, half of the grid is coming from F1 Academy drivers. It gives them much more exposure. It's interesting because I was talking to a driver who's doing fantastically well now. I was talking 1 hour ago with him, but he's not part of an academy. And he was telling me, how can I try to, flash a little bit in Formula One? Because when a Red Bull driver or when an Alpine driver or when is doing well, obviously the exposure is bigger. And on top of that, they have also a quite strong preparation. They probably have more capacities of doing simulators. They have more, there are all these things that they can do, which helps at the end of the day. So, yes, it's very good. It's a plus. And we're so happy to be closer to Formula One than we were at the very beginning. And it's also part of, let's say, the management of the overall group now, and the fact that we feel that we have become quite strategic in the overall Formula One group. And that's a very, very nice feeling.
Look, we've mentioned a number of drivers already. I did want to ask you about your inaugural champion, Nico Rosberg. How important was it for you that he immediately got the bump up to F1 with Williams the following year, just for the effect it would have on your championship?
It was extremely important that it happened because it was the first season of GP2. The very beginning of GP2 was a little bit complicated in terms of reliability. I don't know if you remember that.
did we have rolling starts for a while?
We did.
Yeah. We did. We had rolling starts for a while. So, after that, with 20 years after, we laugh about it, but it was not so funny. Seriously, to have Nico being directly into Formula One right after. We had Kovalainen, who was P2 in the championship, who then became driver with F2, and then with Renault, and then with McLaren. To have Piquet also that got into Formula One. We had really quite rapidly the interest and the attraction of the Formula One world, but it's also because those drivers were very strong. It was not just GP2. The fact that we were racing with Formula One, of course, helped. The fact that the races were very spectacular with GP2, much more than they were with Formula 3000 before, also helped. But it was also the talent. But definitely, it helped because after that, GP2, and there were quite a lot of competition from other championships, but GP2 was the place to be. And the drivers were first trying to go to GP2, and if they could not, they were going to other categories.
I mean, it's an extraordinary roster of talent. Rosberg, Hamilton, Hülkenberg. Now, there's a guy who I would have expected to have more success in Formula One than he actually has.
I quite agree. Nico Hülkenberg was a great driver. He won as a rookie as well, and he did a fantastic job. And he's done a quite long career in Formula One, but maybe he was not at the right place at the right moment. Maybe it was not the right car, maybe whatever. But it didn't work for him as he could have done. And you know, the fact that he hasn't won a race is quite incredible. But there's sometimes some surprises like this. There's another driver that I rated extremely high. It was Stoffel Vandoorne. And Stoffel didn't do as well in Formula 1 as he should have done, and finally had a quite short career in Formula 1. So sometimes you have difficulties for their careers and it's not working the same way.
Bruno, what about Charles Leclerc, champion in 2017? I mean, when I think of that season, I think of Baku, the race just after his father had passed away. What an extraordinary performance.
Well, the first race I'm thinking of when I think of Charles Leclerc was the race two in Bahrain, where he did a pit stop, which was a sprint race, and he won, and it was absolutely amazing. I remember when I saw him stopping, I thought, I'm not an engineer, but I don't understand what they're doing. I think this is completely crazy. Because he was leading the race, he stopped, and he rejoined the race. He was like P10, P12, something like this, and he won it. So it was a brilliant strategy from his team, but it was an incredible race from him. And then, of course, he won in Baku after his father passed away, and it was absolutely amazing, and it was very, very emotional for everybody. He was in F3 and in F2. No, he was in GP3, and we were not F3 yet, and in F2. But he was such a charming guy. Everybody liked him. He really left a very, very, very good memory to everybody in F2. And we knew he was going to do something very, very special. That was quite clear. And then he arrived with Sauber, with Fred at that time, which we know, as you say, knows how to deal with drivers. And the good thing is that now they're together again.
Well, and just look at the emotion in Monaco when he won, became the first Monégasque driver to win the Grand Prix there. Charles certainly is still a very popular man. But also another race, but funnily enough, a Formula One race, of course, Charles' first win was in Spa in 2019.
Yeah,
that tragic weekend, of course, when Antoine Hubert passed away in Formula 2. Was that the most difficult moment of your career?
Definitely. Definitely. It was a very, very, very difficult weekend for everybody. When I say definitely, it's not for me. It was for his family. It was for everybody who was present there. It was a complete tragedy. And it was, we know motor racing is dangerous. And we repeat, motor racing is dangerous. But at the end of the day, we forget about it. And sometimes you have a callback like this one, that's where you go, wow. And everybody is asking themselves the same question, should we do that? Should we continue? It's a very, very, very difficult time that you're having at that moment, because nobody's expecting that it can happen. And we all know, and it's written on your pass, motor racing is dangerous, but we forget about it. And motor racing can be not only dangerous, but incredibly cruel. And that's exactly what happened that weekend.
What did F2 and motorsport in general, do you think, learn from that weekend, other than obviously a reminder that motorsport is dangerous?
Well, an accident like this is just a succession of complete, incredible and tragic details. And what happened the first lap, and what happened the second lap, and the accident, and the way he came back to the track, and the way the other car was coming, and I don't want to go into those details because they're quite painful, but it was really, really a succession of terrible occurrences. Of course, we reacted immediately on what we could react. And for instance, we introduced the season after the TPMS on the F2 cars. So it's a way to understand if there's a loss of pressure on tires, because obviously that had been one of the issue that conducted the accident. We also introduced tether cable for the crash box, the rear crash box, which we didn't have in F2 immediately. And then after that, for the new generation car, we've been working with the FIA, because it's more the FIA than us that is deciding on this kind of issues. But we've been working very, very carefully on the push test, the crash test. We increased the weight, but of course the safety of the cockpit. And that's something, because F2 car is having the same standards of safety as Formula 1 for a car that is going slightly slower. Which is very important. There's a lot of things that have been changing, and with criteria that are much more difficult to reach than we had before. So that's something that's been done also, but with the new generation car.
And much of that is going to be passed down to the F3 car that comes in 2025?
Completely. Completely. Exactly the same.
Okay. Well, when we're talking drivers, it's that age-old question, Bruno. I'm going to put you on the spot. Who's the best you've seen since 2005?
Oof.
Are you going to sit on the fence or are you going to...
In F2 or generally? Or in driver's management
the,
as well?
No, the guys that have come through the system, through your ladder, F2, F3.
You know, it's difficult. Lewis, of course, definitely would be one of them. Saying who's the greatest, I don't know. It's very, very difficult.
Give me your top three then.
Lewis, Charles... Difficult to say, and between, you know, George, Lando, and of course, Oscar as well has been doing amazingly. And then in the drivers that have been managing, one for me that is absolutely amazing, and has been always an amazing driver, is Fernando. But he's not part of the path.
There are no women in F2 this season. When are we going to see a girl winning in Formula 2? How far off is that?
I want already to see a girl doing well in Formula 2, to start with. We had Tatiana, and Tatiana had some good times and some more difficult times as well. At the moment, the one who is the closest to Formula 2 is Sophia.
Sophia Flush, who is in F3
at the moment. The reason why there are not so many girls in the business as drivers, and there are not so many girls arriving, is that at the basis, you know, there are so many more boys than girls that are being, you know, and trying to move forward. And we need to make sure that we have not only the quality, but we have a quantity as well. And that's very, very important. And at the moment, the quantity was not enough. And then those girls need to have a proper preparation as well. And that's something that is extremely demanding, and they're all capable of doing it. But it's something that, you know, they need to do exactly the same as their male counterpart in terms of fitness, preparation, track time, because that's the problem as well. All the female drivers never had enough track time, you know, and they're coming. And it's so we need to make sure that when they come to F2, they will be ready.
Well, where does F1 Academy fit into all this? You helped set up F1 Academy. Do you see that as a feeder, if you like, to Formula 3?
I'd love to see that as a feeder to Formula 3. We need to be sure, and this something is a discussion I had with Susie many times, we need to be sure when they get to Formula 3 that they're going to do well. My dream for the moment would be to see Sofia being P12 in qualifying and starting the race one, the sprint race, in pole position. And you have no idea, you know, the message it would send to everybody. And that's exactly what I'm not asking her to win races tomorrow. I'm asking her already to have this kind of level, which would be, you know, a good way to start. Formula One Academy is working on that. Formula One Academy also, with the exposure that it's having now all over the world, is also a great motivation for young girls to be willing to do this kind of career and to be willing to go to track, to start to do go-karting and then advance in the category. So, of course, it's in the right direction. Now, they all need to have as much track time as possible. And now you see a few drivers from Formula One Academy who are doing a double program with either British Formula 4, with Formula Regional. And I think that's great, because that's exactly what they need. They need preparation, they need track time, and they need motivation. But they have motivation, there's no doubt about that. And we need to have a quantity that is coming as much as possible, because that's the way you will get a feminine Lewis Hamilton one day.
And someone like Abby Pulling or Dorian Pan, both front runners in Academy this year. Have the conversations started about next year in F3, or is it still too early? We're speaking, of course, June 2024.
It's the goal of all these drivers. They want to come to F3, and I think it's fantastic. For me, I love to hear that. So the question, and it's a discussion also that I'm having with Susie, is Dorian obviously is a very talented driver. There's no doubt about that. She's been doing a lot of endurance before coming into single-seater. Now she's doing well in single-seater. She's doing also Formula Regional. And let's see at the end of the season if she's ready for Formula 3 or if she has to do another year of Formula Regional. I don't know. Same thing for Abby. Abby is doing the same time British F4 and F1 Academy. So I'm following extremely carefully all these drivers because I want to be sure that they're not going to come to make the number. I want to be sure that they're going to come and be ready and beat the boys and overtake the boys like Sofia is doing now in Formula 3. And that's really what you want to see.
Look, we've spent so much time talking about other people's career paths, Bruno. I did want to ask, was this your goal all along, what you're doing now? I mean, was there motor racing in your family? Did you ever want to drive?
No.
In a word.
No, not at all. No, actually, no, I was following Formula One when I was young. And, you know, I loved the years of the fight of Senna and Prost. And
were you a Prost or a Senna man?
But of course, I'm French. I was a Prost man. But I admired Senna a lot. But I was a Prost man.
But no racing in your family?
No, no racing in my family. And then it came by, opportunity at some point where was in 1993. End of 1992, and I was approached by, there was a French team called Ligier, and I was approached by some representative of the teams because Guy Ligier was selling the team to a new shareholder, and they had to find someone that they would agree to work with. I met with Guy, and I met with Cyril de Rouvre at that time, and they offered me the job. And then I moved to Magny-Cours.
Of course, which was the base of Ligier.
Yeah, the base of Ligier.
And Flavio Briatore buys the team.
Well, it's been a quite interesting story because I arrived at Ligier. And a few months after I arrived, the new owner was sent to jail. So I became more or less, I had no experience, but I had to run the team because the new owner was not there anymore. And that's when Flavio arrived and wanting to buy the team. Originally, Benetton wanted to buy the team. Then finally, Flavio decided that he wanted to do it by himself. And so I negotiated against Flavio because I was negotiating for the seller and he was the buyer.
And I bet you he reminds you of that every day still.
We forgot about that.
And you're supposed still working together today? I mean, is he still involved somehow in F2 and F3?
No, he's not involved in F2 and F3, but he's still involved in Formula One. He's still working with Stefano on a few things. And I'm also working with Flavio on other businesses. You know, I'm also involved in his restaurants and discotheques. And, I'm a sleeping partner, but I'm a partner in most of his businesses as well. And, Flavio is someone... We shook hands 30 years ago. We never exchanged a piece of paper between him and I, and we're still together.
Wow. Now, you went from Ligier, and then I think you worked at Supertech for a while, which was the engine manufacturing company that took on the Renault, the works Renault engines, when Renault pulled out of Formula One at the end of 1997. What was your role, first of all, in that company? Did you run Supertech?
Yeah. I did. Actually, what happened is, I stayed at Ligier with Flavio. Flavio was with Benetton. I was with Ligier at that time. But Flavio was the owner of Ligier. And after 3 years, 4 years, we sold Ligier to Alain Prost. And then I stayed with Flavio. Because in the same time as we sold Ligier, more or less, Flavio left Benetton. And so I went, I left to live in London and to continue to work with him because we were working very, very well together. And that's at that time we started the Supertech business because Renault was not involved in Formula One anymore, but they still wanted to work on the engine side because they had the plan for the future to come back. And so they asked us to commercialize the Supertech engines, which we did for a few years. And then Renault came back to Formula One. Flavio became team principal of Renault. And I started several businesses in the periphery of that, including the driver's management, and then GP2.
What came first, the driver management or the young driver program? I suppose that's the same thing.
No, yeah, the young driver program. I started the young driver program while we were still doing Supertech, and then I continued it for quite a while. But then when I started GP2, you know, after a couple of years, there was a little bit of conflict of interest for me, running a series and also having drivers in the series. You know, I decided that it was better to step aside from the driver's management business, except for the drivers we had historically and that were already in Formula One.
Weber, Alonso, Trulli, Fisichella. It was busy time.
It was very busy time.
Look, you mentioned mentioned Alonso earlier. Can we just expand on him a little bit? Why is he so special? You've seen so many drivers come and go in your career. What stands out about Fernando Alonso?
I think he's the best driver I've ever seen, to be honest. I think Fernando is completely amazing. He's such a racer. He has an understanding of the car. He's a smart driver. He has an understanding of the race. And he started to have it very early in his career. He's a clever guy. And he's so incredibly talented.
So why has he only won 2 world titles and 32 Grand Prix?
Well, that's a very good question.
Because you say he's smart. He can see he's got a 360 view of everything that's going on. He's got huge talent. Why hasn't it happened for him on a more regular basis?
Some drivers are at the right place at the right moment and some others are not. And Fernando moved to McLaren, and then there was the big fights he was having with Lewis, which didn't make things simple. And they lost the championship where, you know, they had the best car and the best driver. So it was quite incredible. And then, he went back to Renault and the car was not the best either. Then he went to Ferrari and the car was not the best either. Then he went back to McLaren and the car was not the best either. At the end of the day, I agree. I think it's completely incredible when you look at his career and the length of his career that he won only 2 championships because he's an outstanding driver.
Do you think he's as quick now as he was 20 years ago?
He is. I think he's smarter than he was. I think his science of the race has developed, incredibly. And I think he's at least as quick as he was. And I'm completely amazed to see how at 42 he still has the motivation to continue and to, to start the season and go back to the gym and start testing and go back traveling. And it's very, very demanding. And that he's been doing that. And he's still like a kid. And he loves it like a little kid. So that's where he's very special.
He is very, very special. What about you, though? Did you ever want to run your own team? I know you say that you were running, in inverted commas, Ligier for a while, although Flavio was the boss. Did you ever want to have Bruno Michel Grand Prix?
No. No. I did it with Ligier, and that was good enough. And I think I have a much better job now. I prefer it so much. As I say, laughing with the teams, I'm the only one who wins every weekend.
And you make stars. You're the star maker. You're the king maker, aren't you?
Well, I'm not really making stars. I'm giving them the means to show their capacities. But honestly, the teams are making stars much more than I do. And it's not humility when I say that. They are the one working with the drivers. They are the one developing the drivers. And I've got a lot of admiration for what they're doing. When you see a guy like Fred and what he's been doing, all the drivers he's been working with, he's got a talent that probably I would not have.
Did you always believe with Fred Vasseur, even when he was in GP2, that he had eyes for Formula One?
Absolutely.
You knew that from the beginning?
No, I didn't believe yet. I probably knew he had eyes for Formula One. He didn't know yet. it's funny because Fred had an F3 team when I started GP2. And I remember I had to have a phone call with him that lasted for hours to convince him to come because he was, I don't know, I'm not sure, it's difficult. He was doing this jump was for something really big for him. And then finally I convinced him, he came. And obviously, Fred has always been, he has a very, very intelligent view of what he's doing with his team, with the RT, that he's been doing with the RT. And it was quite obvious that Fred had a real future and to go higher. now going to Ferrari, you know, my God, it's a, it's a major achievement. But yeah, Fred was good. And there are always, you know, a few team principals that you can tell, you know, they have talent to go higher.
And I know Red Bull Racing was already underway when you created GP2 in 2005, but Christian Horner was still very much involved in Arden back then. So yeah. You've had dealings with him as well.
Well, I negotiated with him that he joined GP2 at that time. He was the star team of Formula 3000 because he had been winning the title, I think, the last two, three, maybe four seasons. So he was doing a very strong job. So for me, it was important when I started GP2 to have Arden. That's why I you know, in the negotiation, I gave him Kovalainen, and that was part of the negotiation as well.
But you know, you say you had to persuade Fred to make the jump from F3 up to GP2. Was it an easier...
Oh, Christian wanted to come. There was no doubt about that. You know, I knew he wanted to come. But then the funny thing is that, you know, we did the deal and the first testing, and then suddenly he called me one day and he said, you know, Bruno, I'm not going to be in charge of Arden anymore because I'm joining Red Bull. So I said, well done. But so he had no time to be a real GP2 team principal, but he was always involved and he was always watching what was happening. And I was still having quite a lot of conversation with him on GP2 and on his team.
Oh, Bruno, it's been a fascinating chat. Thank you for sharing everything that you're doing now. But I love your story as well with Ligier and Flavio and everything that's going on. Can we just end our chat in that what is now the traditional way on Beyond the Grid? Some quick fire questions. First up, what else are you good at?
I don't know.
I've got an idea, Bruno. Riding motorcycles.
Yeah. Well, you know, I used to be good at, but I had a big accident a few months ago, so I'm not that good at anymore. Yeah, but I'm riding a lot of motorcycles. But not at all in a fast way. Not for me, a motorcycle is not something where you go fast and speed, and I don't go to tracks. And for me, motorcycle is... You know, it's freedom. It's to be in the most remote places in the world and enjoying them, and just being on your motorbike. And I know you do the same. Is you just feel different.
Where is the remotest place you've ridden a motorbike?
Everywhere, South America, quite a lot. Asia, quite a lot. Africa, quite a lot as well. Central America as well. Maybe the most remote place I've been to, or at least that I thought was, when I was the Namibia desert, going from South Africa to the Vic Falls. It was a quite long trip. It was a 3.5 week trip.
Bruno, you're going to be telling me you're doing the Dakar soon.
No, because I don't like to go fast. I don't like to go fast. For me, it's evasion. That's what I like with...
Do you know
what?
Your former driver, Mark Webber, I'm sure, you know, he does...
But we ride together.
Oh, do you? Okay, right. Yeah. There you go.
We ride together. Mark told me the best thing he's done since he stopped racing was to buy his bike. And now we were supposed to ride this year after Melbourne, but unfortunately, with my leg, I couldn't do it. But we're going to do it next year, for sure. And we already rode.
Back to the quickfire questions. Who in racing... Dead or alive, would you like to be stuck in a lift with?
Oh, Fred or Flavio, one of the two. Or Bernie as well. I was getting along very, very well with Bernie. And, you know, it was also somebody very, very enjoyable.
Who would play you in a film?
No, I think saying Al Pacino is a bit too much, to be honest.
Come on, Al Pacino, I can see it. Bruno, what about this one then? Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
I got a lot of cool persons in my contacts. You know, I've got friends from very, very old time, and I got my kids. I'm spending a lot of time with them, and they're very cool as well. And
are your kids involved in racing?
Not at all. But they come to races now. You know, it's the fun part is that you know, over the last few years, the young generation now is extremely interested in racing. And it's funny because my kids, when they were young, they didn't even know what I was doing. And now they love it. And they come. So, yeah, probably my kids, yeah.
Final one. If you hosted a podcast like this, who would be your first guest?
Flavio. Flavio, for sure.
I think we should make that happen. Bruno, great to chat. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It was very nice.
What a fascinating chat. And for the record, I think Al Pacino is definitely the man to play Bruno in a film. Isn't he an interesting guy? And with there being so much paddock chatter about who will graduate from F2 to F1 next year, now seemed the perfect time for us to learn more about F1's feeder series. And look out for the new generation F3 car that we discussed. It's set to be unveiled at the Italian Grand Prix just after the summer break. Now, as ever, please let me know what you think of this conversation and send in any stories or memories that you have about today's F1 stars in F2 or F3. We love reading your messages. I'm at TomClarksonF1, or you can use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. Which brings us on to last week's episode with Red Bull's chief engineer, Paul Moynihan. Many of you love hearing from the engineers in the pit lane, and Paul was fascinating about many things. I thought Alice Coppenole summed Paul up well with this message. Pedals, love this man, funny, knowledgeable, and a true gentleman, one of the Red Bull cornerstones since its inception. That is Pedals. Thank you for the message, Alice. Well, that's pretty much it for this week. Remember to check out the latest episode of F1 Nation, in which Albert Fabrega from ESPN and I discuss last week's thrilling Hungarian Grand Prix. And why not take a look at the F2 and F3 websites for all the latest on their seasons? You can also watch the highlights of every race on the F1 YouTube channel. And if you buy an F1 race ticket for certain weekends, you get to watch all the F2 and F3 action as well. So why not book your seat at tickets.formula1.com? I'll be back next week with another guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.